This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Beer and wine evoke some mixed feelings from many people, but they're undoubtedly part of American culture. For that matter, alcoholic beverages hold a key role in many cultures and likely have done so for longer than there are historical records to document it. Pat McGovern, known to many as Dr. Pat, is an archaeologist of fermented beverages, and he's, forgive the pun here, distilled much of what he's learned in his new book, Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. He joins me now via Skype. Dr. Pat, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
How far back does the history of fermented beverages go? Do we even know?
Not really, because humans and hominids and so forth have been around for a long time, millions of years, and presumably they would have known about, you know, the different sweet concoctions that can easily ferment into a beverage with alcohol. So you have honey, which is the highest source concentration of sugar in nature, which they certainly would have known where those locations were. And if you dilute that down with water, it will, the yeasts that are already present in the honey will ferment it to mead. You have high sugar fruits. You know, if you're in Africa to begin with, millions of years ago, you could have had marula fruit down in South Africa, figs, dates, and so forth in different areas. And they certainly would have exploited those. And in the process, juice from the fruit might accumulate. And again, yeast are associated with the skins of high sugar fruits, so you get fermentation in that way too.
We tend to think of alcoholic beverages as maybe recreational beverages, but you hypothesize that fermented drinks, alcoholic drinks, may have actually played an important role in the development of early human cultures. How so?
Well, I think that it what alcoholic beverages do, and which is not always it's recognized by people, but not always stressed in the medical community, is it breaks down barriers between people, and so it brings groups together, and you know, opens them up to one another, and it also, you know, frees them up to maybe try out, you know, different kinds of words, grunts, or whatever in the early days, dancing, music, and so forth. And besides, it really is the universal medicine of humankind in that alcohol does kill off the harmful bacteria that you find in water. So a person that was drinking a fermented beverage rather than just raw water had a better chance of living longer, having less disease, and presumably reproducing more, too.
I mean, that idea that, you know, people maybe hundreds of years ago would drink beer or rum, what have you, instead of water because the quality of the water was so poor. That's an idea that's out there a lot. But do you think that was an acknowledged or intentional thing going back? You're talking about thousands to millions of years, that there was some health benefit to this recognized?
Well, yes. I mean, I think also when you tie in looking through your environment for all different kinds of herbs and spices and so forth that might have medicinal benefit, you can dissolve the compounds that have benefit, you know, before this is before synthetic medicines, obviously. So, you know, if you're interested in living longer, you're going to be searching your environment pretty carefully for these herbs. But those compounds in the herbs will be put into solution much more easily in an alcoholic medium than in water. And so humans and, you know, our earlier ancestors would have probably been experimenting with that. And so it's, you know, it's really quite likely that it occurred. The problem is for the most of the time that humans have been on the planet, say 99% of the time, we really have very limited information. So the Paleolithic period, which, you know, you could push back to 2 or 3 million years ago, is, or, you know, since Homo sapiens, you know, the last 200,000 years, is a time that we know very little about. We have no containers for the fermented beverages. We assume that they were using things like leather and wood, which unfortunately self-destruct. But it's just based on the physiological genetic relationships between animals being attracted to sugar and alcohol, we can assume that they would be quite interested in these alcoholic beverages and that they would have this medicinal value as well.
So where does the physical archaeological record pick up when it comes to fermented beverages? What's the oldest container or the oldest physical evidence that we have of some sort of fermented beverage?
Well, the oldest is from China that we've been able to document chemically and archaeobotanically. So it's about 7,000 BC from the Yellow River Valley from a site called Jiahu. And it's a very interesting early Neolithic site. So they're just beginning to settle down into permanent villages, year-round villages. And they have some of the earliest rice there. They have some of the earliest playable musical instruments that still play traditional Chinese music, believe it or not. But China has this long tradition in many respects, in this case going back 9,000 years.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with archaeologist Pat McGovern about his new book, Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. Let's talk about that recreating process. I mean, first you have to figure out what might have been in some ancient drink. And this isn't just, you know, reading a recipe that somebody wrote down a couple thousand years ago. You actually go and do a chemical analysis of old containers to figure out what would have been in that container. Can you explain that process a little bit?
Well, it's a very long, lengthy process, which takes a lot of effort. But fortunately, in the last 25, 30 years, we've gotten chemical instruments that are very sensitive and can pick up the organic compounds that we're interested in that tell us what the original natural products or the recipe of the brew would have been. And so we use things like liquid chromatography, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and we try to target particular compounds that we could call marker compounds, biomarkers, fingerprint compounds of those natural products. So, for instance, on the Chinese beverage from Jiahu, we had tartaric acid, which is also found in grapes and in hawthorn fruit. And as it turned out, we originally identified those two fruits as the primary constituents, along with honey based on presence of beeswax, and then rice as the main carbohydrate resource, because, and it also has some of the earliest rice. Well, archaeobotanically, then, they came back to look at the fruit question by going through the soil remains that they had for all the seeds. And the only two fruits that were identified were hawthorn fruit and grape. And China has more species of grape than anywhere else in the world, although most of it's not made into wine. Most of that comes from the Eurasian grape. But some of the grapes there are very high in sugar, so they would have been quite attractive. So it all, you know, fits together then as an extreme beverage based on that chemical information and the botanical information and, you know, other subsidiary arguments about the kinds of vessels that were used that were intended for liquids.
You're talking about all of this high-tech analysis that you can figure out which fruits and the sugar types that were there. But one thing you can't detect because it evaporates is alcohol. How can you be sure that the beverages that you're studying were actually fermented alcoholic beverages and not just some fancy juice drink?
Right. I mean, that is the question. I mean, if we have a vessel, and the way the argument runs is you have a pottery vessel usually, which absorbs ancient organic liquids, you know, that are made from organics, and then you have specific properties of that vessel which suggests that it contained a liquid. It has maybe a narrow mouth. It has a high neck. It has residue on the inside that's restricted to the bottom or along one side. And it doesn't show any, you know, evidence of being that solid and accumulating, you know, a residue that you could really look at and say, oh, well, that has to be something other than a liquid. But once you've got a liquid of a high sugar fruit or honey, like I said before, you've got yeast associated that will start the fermentation, and you will go to a wine or a mead or whatever in a very short order, especially in a warm climate. The real issue then, too, from an archaeological standpoint, is how do you, you know, if your main interest is the mind-altering drug, alcohol, how do you keep it from going to vinegar? And that is something that Pliny the Elder, for instance, one of the ancient Roman writers, said, humans have spent more time trying to figure this one out. We have evidence for that in terms of the additives that are put along with the fermented beverage. Even though we don't have the alcohol per se, you know, we can see that they're putting antioxidants in with it to keep it from going to vinegar. So it's a, sort of a combination of those kinds of arguments that are used. Also, we sometimes are able to retrieve ancient DNA that shows that a yeast was present. For instance, we did that with one of the very early, the earliest example of grape wine from Egypt going back to about 3000 BC. We had actual strands of DNA that we could say were related to the yeast Saccharomyces.
We tend to have some pretty narrow definitions of beer or wine these days, but you've already mentioned with this ancient Chinese drink, you called it an extreme beverage. When you look at these ancient containers and analyze what's actually there, it's not just grapes and yeast to make wine or not just barley and hops to make beer. What kinds of mixtures of ingredients, what are some of the most extreme beverages you've found so far?
Well, I think that the Chinese is a good example. Another one that we did, the first one we did together with Dogfish Head Brewery, was Midas Touch.
From the tomb, presumably, of King Midas, or right. It wasn't clear if it was King Midas or maybe his father, right?
His father, Gordius, is another possibility. I mean, we don't have an inscription that says, you know, here lies Midas or his father, but it's
that would
obviously
be far too easy. Yeah.
Right. But it's obviously a royal tomb because it has the largest drinking set that, for the Iron Age that's been found, and it has lots of other, you know, textiles that are colored in purple and blue, which are the royal colors of the Near East. So it's clearly, you know, a king that's been buried. We know, you know, he's 60 to 65 years old, died at normal health. And the dating on the tomb is, you know, approximately that of what the real King Midas was, or his father. So, you know, whichever one you choose, we've got the residues coming from the drinking vessels that were used as part of the funerary feast of the king. And we were very fortunate because the Penn Museum excavated that tomb in 1957, brought the residues back here to Philadelphia. And it was, like I say, it's one of the easiest excavations I was ever on because the residues were still in the original paper bags that they were collected in, sitting like two flights of stairs above my laboratory. So I just had to walk up, get the bags, bring them down, and we started the analysis. And that turned out to be quite a complex beverage. Again, you know, very similar to the Jiahu Chinese beverage in that it was a mixture of a wine, a beer, and a mead. So it had grape wine, honey mead, and barley, in this case, because we're in the Middle East rather than rice, as the principal ingredients.
As you alluded to, you've recreated Midas Touch in this case and some of these other ancient brews with Dogfish Head Brewery. How do you, though, go from, you know, I've done a chemical analysis, I have a list of things that were probably in this container thousands of years ago, to here's a recipe and a procedure for how to turn those ingredients into something that you might want to actually drink?
Right. Well, that's the big challenge, of course, and because we don't know exactly, you know, how much of each ingredient there was. We may be missing some ingredients, too, and we have to make assumptions about that. We can carry out the fermentation in different ways. We could, you know, have a beehive, let's say, that, you know, is very self-contained, like a container, that you could do the whole fermentation in. Do you do the individual ingredients separately, then mix them together? One of the underlying principles, you know, I go into this in a lot of detail in the book, and then we have the actual interpretations of a possible recreation for, you know, the home brewer to try out. But one of the things that we try to do is, you know, take these variables that we have and then assume that if we're, especially if we're dealing with a king or some upper class individual and we have similar sense organs, for instance, as our ancestors, you know, the same sort of olfactory bulb and taste buds and so forth, and we all get the same mind-altering experience based on the brain structures that we can assume, you know, from the inside of the skull, then we would want to come up with something that's rather good, you know, delectable, tasty, hot, nutritious, and so forth. So, you know, we always have that as sort of our ultimate goal. I mean, we don't believe that a king you know, we'd want something that tasted awful. And then we just play with the variables and try out different possibilities. And in that way, we learn, you know, what the process might have been and whether it really did work.
I suppose if it totally bombed, that wouldn't be so much fun to taste test. But that sounds like some pretty fun research that you have when you're trying to put these together.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, but, you know, somebody's got to do it, right? It's a tough job. But, yeah, we've had a lot of fun with it, too. I mean, you know, like when we first did Midas Touch, we had a competition among microbrewers who came to an event here at the Penn Museum in which we had Michael Jackson doing a tasting every year. This is not the entertainer, but the beer and the scotch writer who's unfortunately passed away. But every year he'd come to the Penn Museum. So I got up and explained the Midas beverage to the assembled crowd because I couldn't believe at that stage back in year 2000 that you could really make something tasty from mixing beer and wine together. And so I just put out a challenge to them, you know, go back to your breweries and try to come up with a possible interpretation. And so I started getting all these interpretations. I mean, one of the things delivered to my doorstep, and that was kind of, you know, a fun thing to have, you know, make the trial taste tests. And then we were going to do a full recreation of the funerary feast at the museum in the fall, which we did. But one of the basic questions was, what was the bittering agent that would have been used to offset the sugar and the sweetness of the beverage? And hops were definitely ruled out because hops only started to be used probably around 1000 AD. So we're back at 700 BC, you know, and we didn't have any real good chemical evidence of what the bittering agent was. So we tried out, you know, the microbrewers did, different kinds of herbs from that region, like coriander, cumin. And then because I was already, for various reasons I won't go into, but it's in the book, predisposed to Sam Calagione of Dogfish Head, I suggested to him, why not try saffron? Because the residue was very yellow in color. And it's very, of course, he had the touch of gold, and Midas did. And it's a very aromatic, fragrant herb, which... Turkey was well known for, Anatolia was well known for throughout antiquity. The only trouble is saffron happens to be the most expensive spice in the world. So Sam ended up saying, well, this is the most expensive beer he ever made.
Hmm. Every chapter in the book, as you've already alluded to, not only describes the archaeology and the likely ancient drink, but actually gives homebrewers recipes and ideas for variations that they might try on this, especially given how different a lot of these are from, you know, the standard beer or wine recipes that people might see. Are you trying to create a bit of a home brewing revolution with this and bring back some of these ancient extreme beverages?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's already occurring just in the experimentation that goes on in the home brewing world. I was just out at the Home Brewers Conference in Minneapolis. And I did a program also for the United States Bartenders Guild. Well, all these people are, you know, most of the people are experimenting tremendously with all kinds of ingredients. So this is just another, I mean, this shows that this kind of experimentation has been going on right from the beginning. And, you know, if they want to try to sort of enter into that ancient world, this is a way to do it.
That's Pat McGovern, archaeologist and author of Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. He joined us by Skype. Pat, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.